Don't you just love it when somebody who's being quiet and compliant, just hanging out in the background, sees a challenge arise and steps up and speaks out and shows what total gold they've been made of all along? Today, Queen Esther is that person in this story in Esther chapter 5. Up until now, the big characters in this story have been Mordecai the Jew, Xerxes the Persian, and Haman the Agagite. Haman's been revealed as an empty braggart, addicted to the applause his position brought him. Xerxes has been revealed as a thoroughgoing puppet despot, apparently under the control of his courtiers. And even Mordecai the Jew now fades into the story's background as Esther boldly and faithfully acts on her newfound resolution. Her people are now seriously threatened with horrible Haman's decree of genocide, and Esther resolves in chapter 4, the previous chapter, verses 15 to 16, in this way. Mordecai puts the problem to her. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." There, to my mind, is the turning point, the crux in the whole story. The human element that turns back the tide in Persian politics enables the deliverance of God's people from the threat that is facing them. And when the people of God stick their courage to the wall, put their trust in him, God turns the tide of this world's heinous and horrible hostility. Firstly, and there are just 2 points today. Firstly, Esther loves her God and his people, verses 1 to 8. She does that. Doesn't feel it. Doesn't say how much she feels it. She acts. See, if I ask you if you love Jesus, just what are you going to answer? The conventional answer for a compromised queen like this Esther is, it's going to be fairly clearly, no, she certainly hasn't kept kosher. She certainly hasn't obeyed what God's law says about marriage. There's not enough of God's faithfulness looking about her for even her fellow inhabitants of King Xerxes' harem to have a clue that her heritage is Jewish. They just don't know. But what Esther's doing when the chips are down is that she's going to prove that she loves both her God and her people. She certainly hasn't shown it until now. Do you remember what happened between Peter and the Lord in John 21, verses 15 to 19? Peter had dropped a catch or two, or three, denying the Lord 3 times. And then after his resurrection, the Lord comes back to Peter in John 21. He says, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." And again Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." And the third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger you dressed yourself, went where you wanted. But when you're old you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." See, Peter hadn't proved so faithful when the chips were down and hadn't dignified his words with his conduct. We know he'd only recently denied his Saviour 3 times. So here it comes, phrased in varying ways, the question as to whether Peter actually did love Jesus. 3 times, yes, but in response, each and every time, "Feed my lambs," or something similar. And then after the final time, a prophecy of what it would cost Peter to do that. And Jesus said, this is to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. It's really not the faith protestations that matter. It's whether we actually follow a crucified Saviour. In our own experience of our own life and death, readily to go where he leads us, to live or to die simply for doing that. In a life given up to his service, neither Peter nor Esther got it all right. Far from it, would be the summary for both of them. But when it came to commitment to God shown to his people, both of them have the courage born of faith. Here's the thing. Verse 1 shows us, love for God will stick its neck out in a harsh and truly God-hostile world. Esther 5 verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. She wasn't going to get missed. What's going on here then? It was the third day. That's kind of significant. The third day. That rings bells of what had happened with Queen Vashti before and what had gone wrong for her. Yeah, she'd taken her stance, but it was a stance on her own dignity. And now here's the Jewish girl, Esther. And again, the third day chimes with what had happened earlier in this book. And she puts on her royal robes. She's afraid she's been being a little bit rejected as queen because the king hasn't sent for her for 30 days. She puts on her royal robes. And she goes and enters the red zone of Xerxes' own presence without permission. The penalty for which is death, unless he extends his scepter to her, for her to touch and be forgiven for what she's just done walking in on him. Yeah. Love for God, you see, is going to stick its neck out in a harsh, truly God-hostile world. But the woman who loves her God and sticks her neck out has the friend that she needs, and verses 2 and 3 show that. See, if God is dead, Esther's really in trouble as soon as she appears there. We've got archaeology that depicts the king of Persia seated on his throne like this, and chillingly, behind his throne, ready and waiting, stands a big guy wielding the sword to execute people with. And there stands Esther, with only the king between her and the big guy with the sword. Or is that not quite the whole truth? See, in the Old Testament, God doesn't promise to preserve the life of his person, but that of his people. Sometimes his soldiers, shall we say, are not preserved in this life through the conflicts they're going to get called to engage in. The threat to God's cause and God's people is covered in his sovereign promise, but the earthly life of the individual may not be so thoroughly underwritten. And if you understand the culture and the brutality of the Persian culture of that time, and so long as you haven't heard this story already, the tension by this point, as Esther appears where she appears, is going to be spine-tingling. Remember, Esther fears that she has fallen from favour with the king. Back in 411, Esther sent a message to Mordecai to say, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king has but one law, the day he put to death, unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. That doesn't sound terribly confidence-building, does it? And there stands Esther in the red zone, with the big guy standing behind the big man's seat, uninvited in Xerxes' presence. What is going to happen? Well, perhaps uncharacteristically, when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. The queen, the woman of God, who sticks her courage out there, puts her life in the hand of God in faith. That lady, the queen here, Queen Esther, has a friend in heaven. And her life is rather mercifully spared. More than that, contrary to expectation, the king's heart is tender to her needs. The heart of the tyrant is open in verses 3 and 6. The king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given you." Nobody's expecting that. Well, there it is. His heart is opened, and Queen Esther isn't slow. She invites the king and her enemy, Haman, to a feast. And it is at that feast that as they start drinking, Xerxes asks again, verse 6 of chapter 5. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "Now what is your petition? It will be given you. What's your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Do you know, this is an unaccustomed generosity in a situation where we had been led to think, and Esther no doubt has been led to think, this is my life on the line. I could get my chips here. Up to half my kingdom. Wow. Now, apparently that sort of thing is apparently a standard expression, which meant the king was minded to be generous to her, but it wasn't taken totally literally. Same sort of expression Herod uses when Salome dances for Herod and asks for the head of John the Baptist. But here it seems as if Xerxes is saying the one come dressed as the queen is acknowledged to be queen. It's almost as if her royal husband is saying that far from her having fallen from favour, it remains true she is the queen, and what's yours is mine, my dear. Half. Well, in any event, whatever the case, the heart of this tyrant Xerxes has been thoroughly opened. But look, there's a bit of a mystery. What is it with all these banquets? Do you wonder about that? It seems strange. What do you want? You're going to have up to half my kingdom. Come to my banquet. What? This is huge. They agree to come to her banquet. Now then, Herodotus, the Greek historian of the Persian Wars, and he writes a lot for us about Persian culture, he comments on the way the Persians did politics as they drank as well as feasted. That seems to be borne out by the way the king opens negotiations as they get to the drinking here. It's Esther who has set up the drinking bout. Well, we talk politics, we make our deals and so on when we're drinking. So the king's invited Esther to say what she wants up to half the kingdom in that context. And she sets up a situation. What she's done with this banquet is she set up a situation where she actually gets to do proper politics. It's as if she's pressing Xerxes, make good on his offer, in a situation where it's appropriate to not to be asking for a new kitchen or a flash little chariot for the little woman, to get about town, but to letting her in on the serious business of politics. Well, of course, there's politics involved here. Haman has gone and set up this situation where the king has given a decree that the Lord's people are going to be slaughtered. It's big stuff. It's not, can I have something for the house, or something of the sort, a little request. She wants to bring down the most powerful man in the land, Haman, the royal favourite, and turn back the legally binding law that's been passed to bring about the total genocide of God's people. And it's not minor politics she's set her heart on, but the sort that's going to need at least one subsequent banquet to the one that they've been talking at already. See, it is those banquets that where the politics gets done. Now, something then happens because there's an interlude between the first and second banquet. And we get a totally revealing insight into the difference between Esther's heart and Haman's heart. And here's the second major point, really. There's this queen, this Esther, right? And she has really stuck her courage in a place where it shows that she loves her God and she loves his people in verses 1 to 8. It's got that chime with what the Lord said to Peter about feeding his lambs. But the contrast is set up between a woman like that, a woman of faith and strength in God, strong woman of God. Contrast set up between that in verses 1 to 8 and the way in verses 9 to 13 it becomes absolutely evident that Haman loves himself, as if Esther loves her God and his people, but Haman loves himself. Esther's dramatically not loved her own life so much as to shrink from death, but just placed her life in God's hands, and she's done it for the sake of God's cause and God's people. But Haman is a man who loves himself. See in verses 10b, halfway through verse 10 through verse 12. you got there a man who loves himself, celebrating with his sycophants. The man who loves himself celebrates with sycophants, people who suck up to him. You can see that in verses 10b to 12. Haman summons his fan club to brag and boast in front of them in order to feel better about himself. His action's the opposite of what we're seeing in this chapter from Esther. Let me read a few. Verse 10b to 12. He's been to the banquet, right? He's been to the banquet with just him and the king and Esther. And calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the way the king had honoured him, and how he'd elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And then it starts to get incredibly ironic, verse 12. That's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. He really hasn't sussed what Esther's about. See, Esther has become a woman who is committed to serving her God and his people, and Haman quite simply serves himself and his own ego. And as is typical of men of this sort, he's got a very large ego on the surface, which is as incredibly fragile as it could be underneath the surface. Look at verse 13. The man who loves himself hates the man who doesn't applaud him. He's got a massive ego, terribly fragile. He brags about all these things to his wife and his mates who he's called around to, you know, big him up. And then verse 13, he concludes, but all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. See, Mordecai refused to sign up to Haman's personal fan club. He would not bow down to him. Yes, it was passive resistance, but Haman knew what it was about and he hated it. His huge ego was incredibly fragile and threatened by one far less favoured official whose influence was next to nothing when compared to his own. It's just the consistent transgenerational hatred of the Agagites, you know, that clan that Haman belonged to. The enmity of evil against God and his people that God had spoken about way back in Numbers, I believe. God's people who worship Almighty God. Not fragile and human megalomaniacs like Haman. They cannot be expected, these megalomaniacs, to do anything but hate the people who honour their God first, and therefore don't break out in loud applause for mere human megalomaniacs like Haman. Well, what happens next in verse 14 is the man who loves himself hears his own echo and not the voice of true wisdom. He hates the man who doesn't applaud him, but he listens to his own echo from his own personal fan club. His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. And this suggestion delighted Haman and he had the pole set up. Such people are addicted to themselves and do not reckon with God. So here's the conclusion. What's going on in this passage? At the root of the change of heart in Esther, I will go to the king and if I perish, I perish, lies the commitment to follow through on her new resolution. She isn't just saying that to Mordecai, if I perish, I perish. She's resolved to live or to die, but serve God in any case. Haman was going to die, but he would only serve himself, actually. He died for things that really weren't worth anything like dying for. Esther put her life fully on the line, not fully understanding what Christians came later to see, that the man, the woman, is no fool if they give that. If they put that in God's hand to do as he wills. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he can't lose. I'm paraphrasing the words there written by Jim Elliot, an American Christian missionary, one of five people killed during Operation Orca, an attempt to evangelize the Huara, a tribe in Ecuador, who died on January the 8th, 1957, an anniversary marked on Sunday last week. The man was 28 years old. He's no fool who gives what he cannot keep, his life, to gain what he cannot lose, eternity in glory. 28 years old. And you know the miraculous thing then? His wife and the wives of the other guys who died on the Curry River in Ecuador that day, Those wives, they took their own lives in their hands and then placed them in God's hands to visit the selfsame tribe themselves and share the gospel with those needy people who'd killed their own husbands. Now, friends, let's ask the question, do we love Jesus? Esther knew so much less about the God of the covenant than we know now, with the benefit of knowing all about Jesus. But even so, she knew that what God wanted was to know that Esther would put her life where her mouth was. She'd put her life where her mouth was. She never saw the dying love of Jesus, didn't Esther? She didn't see that. Costly sacrifice for our very unworthy sakes. But even Esther not only resolved to serve the Lord, even if it meant she perished, but she put herself, following up on that resolution, she put herself into the red zone in Xerxes' presence for the sake of God's cause and his people, who were now being threatened by the enemies of God. But we do see Jesus, who was made lower than angels for a little while. We see him now crowned with glory and honour because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. That's Hebrews 2, verse 9. What are we living to be loving? That's the issue that separated Esther and Haman, what they were living to be loving. And it's the issue that separates Jesus' people to this day from people who may be around them. Living for his love? Or living to love yourself? Well, let's make it our prayer in this new year that his love so revolutionizes our lives that our gratitude and our service to him know no measure. That we're ready to give what we cannot keep, to gain what we cannot lose with him. Because the glorious outcome of that grace-fed commitment to his cause and to his people is the turning of the triumph of evil to its overthrow. And that is the exciting thing we're going to see next when we come back to the book of Esther, God willing, next week.